Rene Jahil is going to talk on culture and disability, a structure, process, outcome framework. He has both regular and large print copies of his presentation, which I'll be handing out in just a moment. Dr. Jahil, in addition to his MD, also has a PhD in microbiology from Columbia University. He did virology and immunology research for 20 years before moving to public health. He's been very active in disability service, teaching, and research. And in 2010, he received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Disability Section of APHA. And in recent years, his publications have focused on theoretical aspects of epidemiology and disability. So if you would please welcome Dr. Jahil.
My voice does not carry too far, so let me know if you can't hear at the bottom back of the room. This is a theory-based paper and no data, just ideas, and it's over several general themes. One of which is culture, the other one is disability, and the third one, which is not in the abstract that you might have read earlier, is on the ICF, because I couldn't resist bringing the ICF on there. Let me see now. Disclosure, no relations. All of you have just essentially did it. The outline is in three parts. The first one, the first about four slices on the complexity of culture and subcultures. The second part is on the use of a structure process outcome. And the third, to relate cross-cultural issues to disability. And the third part is on the application of these concepts to ICF. So for the first part, this is my first, really my, the past year has been my first having to deal with culture in disability or otherwise, and I keep increasing the feeling of complexity of that field. The more you, the more I work on culture, the more diversified and complex it is. There are numerous kinds of cultures, national, ethnic, religious, institutional, occupational, like professional, age cohort, and so on, and many subcultures, and a given individual usually partakes of several cultures. And then in addition to that, each culture has some important socioeconomic correlates, which interact very gradually with it. So this makes it very difficult. When you fit the culture in the person environment interaction, is becoming something very complex. And I'm just going to bring you some ideas about it. I'm still not really formulated a good framework. This is still evolving. But let's say a few questions. The first one is, where does culture fit in the person environment interaction? It seems that this should be a key point. And one has to look at four areas. In first place, it fits in the person as internalized cultures from past and present environment. It has to fit in the environment itself, and the environment, there is a personal niche of the person, family, friends, and so on. There is the environment at large, national, community, and there is a transactional environment of the person who is having a transaction, say, with a professional, with a provider. And so you deal with a mosaic of cross-cultural interactions very often of various kinds. I'll just give one example of the importance. This is not so much for the complexity of culture, but for its importance. Taking as an example a person with Down syndrome, who has significantly decreased abstract thinking. In industrialized modern society like ours, that person's occupational participation is very restricted, usually to the lowest socio-economic occupational roles. By contrast, in a traditional agrarian society, that person participates in work in the field like anyone else, in completely equal level, at the socio-economic level of the society. In some remote societies, it is actually better to have a child. A mother is happy when she gets a child with Down syndrome because the community considers it as a sort of benefit, a child with a very good disposition. So this shows that depending on the culture, the position of a person in society is so very much affected. Another example. I'm skipping some slides in the interest of time, and you can I would answer questions about slides that I skipped in the discussion if you wish. The second aspect is the structure process outcome, sometimes called SPO, and I'll use the SPO. It was developed by Professor Donavidian in medical care and was used for assessment, as a tool for assessment. I'm somewhat modifying it for this presentation. Oh, there is a typo in this. Under number four, structure should be read material and ideological factor, not intellectual. The intellectual is a typo. It should be ideological factors that influence outcome for the person. Process is the interaction of the person and their interactions with the structure in order to achieve a certain outcome. An outcome is the achieved health-related functional state. Looking quickly at the outcomes, this is not limited to functioning. The outcomes can be disability awareness and management, cultural integrity, personal growth, access, human rights, emotional and physical well-being, happiness, and so on. I will come back to that multiplicity of outcome at the end of the talk. Structure involved in the cross-cultural situation, the structures involved the cultural structures, which are the things I mentioned earlier, and the types of cultures, and the context of cultures, which are the things that I mentioned in terms of relationship of culture to socioeconomic status, class status, and so on. Now, process is interesting in a cross-cultural situation. Process involves the cultural content of interactions, translation across culture, culture brokering between cultural groups, and acculturation of a person. And characteristics of the process are this is not a complete list, but you can include at least cross-cultural competence, cross-cultural and cross-cultural competence includes not only that of the personnel, but also the technical competence of the manufacturer of the instruments that are used. Cross-cultural humility and respect, accuracy of translation across culture, context and limits of advocacy across culture, and then the power relationships. Now, the third part of this rather disjoint presentation is the ICF, and it's very difficult nowadays to talk about anything related to disability without getting involved into the ICF. But the ICF is particularly important because it has number one, in relationship to the structure process outcome that I'm discussing, to have an impact in the field of disability, it must be adapted to the main instruments of that field, and the ICF is the main instrument. But the ICF needs cross-cultural improvement. I mean, this is something that has been noted by a number of people. And another problem, too, is that there are significant differences between the approach of the ICF and the structure process outcome. In comparison of the two approaches, the The SPO is an assessment tool, the ICFC classification system. The SPO is a unit of observation of the SPO is a situation. The unit of observation of the ICF is a person. And the unit of analysis of the SPO, this SPO is procedure. The unit of analysis of the ICF is state of health. So these are two methodologically very distinct conceptual instruments. Now, in terms of cross-cultural options of the ICF, there are three options. One is to rewrite the full ICF into a different version for each major culture. The second one is to use a different instrument for application to non-Western culture, such as a science capabilities approach. And the third one, which is the most conservative one, is to add chapters to existing ICF to account for cross-cultural issues, possibly that can be guided by the SPO approach. So I'm going to give a couple of examples. I mean, this is again, this is a very pilot project. First of all, to briefly recall the principle used for the environmental component. The environmental factors are coded from the perspective of the person whose situation is described. I mean, that's a very important point when you're dealing with a cross-cultural situation. In adapting environmental factors to cross-cultural situations, should be able to continue to code them in the same way as the 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then in the case of a facilitator, a plus 0, 1, etc. Now, in terms of trying to make to translate from approach to the thank you. To the ICF, cross-cultural environmental factors would correspond to cross-cultural structural factors. That is the structure process outcome would put the structural factors into the environment. An example, what this would do is to add a chapter 6 to the environment component, and to give one example, let's say E610, for instance, would be the extent to which environmental culture presents to the person a health-related obstacle or facilitator to a person from a different culture. And then there would be some subgroup with E6100 would be the culture of a nation, E6101 would be the culture of the community, E6102 family or friends, E6103 therapists, and etc. This again is just an initial step, and eventually there might be much more different categories and so on. Going quickly over that, participation, again, one would use the same type of qualifiers. Participation, of course, is involvement in a lab situation in the ICF. In the structure process outcome, I think it's important to note that participation is both an outcome and a process. I mean, that's important for the ICF to thinking about the ICF. An example of activity and participation, again, a simple one, chapter DX10 would be health-related involvement of a person in DX101, own national or ethnic culture, DX102, own religious culture, DX103, other culture, and so on. This could be developed considerably. So, conclusions. course, cultural factors are an important issue in disability and health that has not received enough attention, and they are also very complex. The structural process outcome approach provides one framework for their incorporation in the field of disability and rehabilitation. The ICF is a fundamental tool of disability, of course, and it should include cross-cultural influences, and there are several approaches. We outlined today the most conservative approach, which is to keep the main body and principle of ICF without change, and just to add chapters to the E&D component. This would require a lot of work. I mean, anybody who has been involved in the development of the ICF codes in the 1990s and beyond is aware that, number one, there will be theoretical problems, and number two, there will be operational problems. And whether such approach will be sufficient to account for the theoretical diversity of cross-cultural relationships, this would have to be determined both theoretically and empirically. If the test to that approach survives, then the proposed approach would require an extensive process of consultative and collaborative development, similar to the one that was used for the ICF, with a much greater multicultural participation. And if it does not survive, then one alternative might be to rewrite ICF in versions appropriate to at least resource poor cultures, or development of alternative complementary classification added to the ICF, possibly based on the SENS capability approach. Thank you.
So we'd like to entertain questions from the audience. The only request, please, is that you do use the microphone so that the questions and answers can be recorded.
Currently using tools sometimes with a narrative around the content of this tool actually changes, such as quality of life measures, we are using quality of life measures. No, they're not quality of life measures, they're functional state and health state measures. So, but a narrative around that has changed, is dishonest. The other thing is the format. I think if people cannot engage with a particular format, then it is not just a nice thing to do. I think it's a legal thing, a legally binding thing to offer alternative formats. I think whether it's the ADA, whether it's the United Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities, we need to capture the information in different ways. And whether that is adapting the rule set around it, looking at providing extra time, providing a particular environment for it, providing assistance, or capturing supplementary information via interviews, observations, using complex information and gathering methods with it to get into a complete picture, but excluding people is not an option.
Hi, I'm Linda Jen from Boston University. I really like the lecture, which is really relevant to what you're
doing.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm from Boston University, and I really like this lecture. I have questions for the third presentation of the two presenters. So the first question is, how did you guys select the surveys? I use SurveyMonkey, I use the SIP, like my study, and I found like it's a really long survey, and it was not designed to measure disability. Maybe like functional limitation and adult beliefs are the ones that really like measure active limitations. But most of the questions are more, especially if they have like four questions and they have like other sets of questions. So like, how did you decide which survey do you want to do the analysis? That's my question. And the second question is, I know like it's difficult to distinguish activity and participation in the ICF, but because you put them together, so when you do analysis, I think like in most of questionnaires, of course, there may be more items that measure activity and participation, and less items measure body and function limitations, because like if there are two domains together and there's like one domain or measuring body function. So when you compare the number of the items, would that be a like kind of limitation or something? Like would you think about like distinguish activity and participation by using some sort of method? And I also have a question for the second presenter.
Let the third presenter answer those questions.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, we'll have to kind of break them down. So would you mind?
Sure. I'll try to answer your first question. Great question. The reason we decided to tailor it to the disability question.
Could you speak into the microphone a little more, please? I'm sorry.
We basically called it over 900 questions of all five surveys. We select those questions if they have or their response choices indicate the person they have to deal with. So that's the basic criteria. And also we identify questions they if they were not asked regularly, if they have supplemental files but they were not asked frequently, we then include them. For the SIP, we do functional limitations for adults and focus on adults for this particular study. And then for the core module, we do include questions if they receive any public program support, such as SSDI, SSI, we include those questions. So that's the general guideline we use. It took a while to come up with all the questions that we think they are relevant. But again, if the questions are not asked regularly, the survey regularly needs to. And I am going to answer the second question.
So as far as splitting the decodes into AMP, there's sort of a long history behind that as far as development of the ICF and the way it ended up is that WHO left essentially a decision up to each country approach that issue. From our perspective, what we wanted to know was sort of, you know, how the ICF represented the concept of the National Disability Program relative to eligibility criteria. So the fact that, you know, the DCODEs are combined wasn't as much an issue as the fact that they aren't included in some of the body system listings. What does matter, however, is when you look at some of the survey questions, you know, from an SSA perspective, they define disability relative to your ability to work. So that would be considered more of a participation code. So even though we coded questions as Z codes, you know, we had to go back and look at, okay, within those D codes, you know, which ones encompass content relative to participation or participation focused types of areas that this work.
A question for presentation. And my question is, I found it interesting that the way you define disability by using, like, measuring if they have difficulty in participating in self-care activities. So, because, like, I'm a user of ICF as well, so I have a question is, like, how did you come out this definition, and what if people, they have difficulty participating in self-care, but they don't have difficulties participating in, like, participation, like, work or meal preparation or something else? Like, would you still define them have disability or not, or in the opposite way? And also, my second question is, do you, like, how much difficulty would you consider if they have difficulty?
Yeah, thank you for your questions. Like, I always have a lot of questions, so I can really, so to answer that, the Simone, as part of that project, they just collected difficulties on these basic ADLs. I mean, there's other questions like instrumental activities of daily living, like making phone calls, managing money. Those questions weren't asked, so I don't really have that data. And this context is very different, so some of those instrumental activities may not even be relevant at all. I mean, it's hard to really show you more pictures, but I mean, these are people living in really remote areas, you know, without access to electricity or running water. So what we do have is those ADL measures, and they were coded such that if you reported, you know, some difficulty, a lot of difficulty, or you cannot do it, to make it somewhat comparable to the U.S. questions, you know, you have to compare apples to apples. So they were coded dichotomously so that, you know, some difficulty or unable to do it, that was counted as, you know, a limitation, essentially. So that's how that was done.